This is Reverend Abby Tennis, lead minister at First Unitarian Church of Philadelphia. Grateful. There is a large duckling yellow hardcover book in my mother's house called A Baby Book. It is my baby book, in fact. The book where my parents recorded the details of my birth and development. I was 10 and a half pounds when I was born. My grandmother gave me my first bath. There are pictures from the first day of school every fall. There's a tiny ink footprint from my first days on Earth. When I was a kid, this book was a treasure trove of information about the me that I didn't remember anymore. And over time, as I grew, there were fewer and fewer entries until they almost petered out. But then, in the height of my cantankerous teens, I got into a huge fight with my mother. I no longer remember why we fought, but I do remember that I screamed, "Bleep you, Mom!" Except, of course, I didn't say bleep. I said something much worse, and you can imagine what that was. My mother calmly, so calmly, walked into the dining room, pulled down that big duckling yellow book from the bookshelf, opened to a new page, and wrote, 1997. Abby screams, "Bleep you, Mom!" at the top of her lungs for the very first time. My family members all have good senses of humor. There are times when we can laugh at our fights, and then we can use our indoor voices to say why we're really upset. We can get back into right relationship with one another. And I'd like to say that 1997 was the last time I screamed, "Bleep you," at anyone, but I'm not that good a liar. I'd like to say that I've been able to laugh it off every time, like I did that day, but I'm not that good a person. So, those of us in the United States are about to have Thanksgiving. And I'm guessing that many of you will be spending the holiday with family, so you know what I'm talking about, right? That laughter and also the dreaded fighting, the anxiety as well as comfort, gladness, and sadness. Being with your family over the holidays can be wonderful. You can get to eat second helpings of your aunt's famous greens. You can watch your hometown's football game. You can pass around the newest family baby. In my family, we usually have more types of pie at Thanksgiving than we have guests. There are wonderful things about family. But family can also push your buttons, right? Dad's knee is acting up again, but he's too proud to ask for help with the yard work, and you are worried sick. Or it's 2 p.m. and your son-in-law is sitting next to his 3-year-old niece drinking his fourth beer and yelling obscenities at the TV. Cousin Sarah refuses to acknowledge your partnership of 10 years and keeps calling your longtime wife your, quote, friend. We show up exhausted after a long drive with a screaming 2-year-old, only for our mother to criticize our parenting style. Or our son returns home from his first psychology class in college and blames us for all of his maladjustment in life. No matter how patient we are, we know that we will erupt into a fight with someone who voted differently than us. No matter how we yearn for love and affirmation from our parents, they will never be able to express their feelings in ways that feel good to us. It makes sense that our families push our buttons. After all, they are the ones who installed those particular buttons in the first place. But getting into that same fight year after year with that same family member can get wearing. Sometimes it gets bad enough that we avoid the family just to avoid the fight. Or maybe our anger is deeper than irritation. Maybe there's a history of abuse in our family that no one talks about. Maybe our wounds come from years of being put down and neglected, and overlooked. Being away from family over the holidays, or having no family, or just being alone can also feel awful, even when it's sometimes what we've chosen, even when it's the right choice. No matter what, some of us find that the holiday season rivals only the election season as the most stressful and anger-provoking time of the year. And yet, sitting next to the person who pushes our buttons more than any other person in the entire world, we are told that this is a time for gratitude. There is a line in a gospel song by Brian Tate that's called Overflowing, where the choir sings these words, "Grateful in gladness, grateful in sadness, grateful in gladness, grateful in sadness." This line has always struck me because I've always associated gratitude with the times that we're happy. It's easy to be grateful in gladness. But if gratitude is not simply some nuance of gladness, if gratitude is perhaps not even emotion at all, then what is it? Grateful in gladness, grateful in sadness. Like many of you, I have been looking for gratitude, desperately looking for gratitude in the midst of a steady stream of horror. I have been looking for gratitude after reading that we only have 12 years to turn around climate change if we hope to avert utter catastrophe, and that we are on our way to pushing a million different species to extinction, a million. I've been looking for gratitude for my fellow Americans who voted for and still support a leadership team that will do nothing to halt the violence against trans people, who will do nothing to halt the increase of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, who have separated thousands of immigrant children from their parents. I've been looking for gratitude. I have been looking for gratitude when beloved congregants and friends and other loved ones are in the hospital, or they're facing frightening diagnoses, or assaults, or uncertainty about whether they will recover, about whether they will survive. If I don't feel gladness, where can I find gratitude? Too often recently, the place that I have been able to look for gratitude is in the sadness. Because deep down, I know that gratitude lives there too. Grateful in gladness, grateful in sadness. I'm talking about the gratitude that makes my body weak and pours as tears from my eyes when I leave the hospital room of someone who might have died but didn't. I'm talking about the kind of gratitude that bowled me over upon entering an African Methodist Episcopal church for a prayer vigil the night after a white supremacist, radical Christian terrorist massacred 9 Black people of faith at another African Methodist Episcopal church in Charleston. The gratitude that I felt upon hearing that AME choir begin to sing, "How great is our God! Sing with me, how great is our God! And all will see how great is our God!" catastrophe leading to jubilant song. I've been looking for gratitude in sadness, the kind of gratitude I feel when I'm with people who choose faith in the face of devastation, gratitude for those who choose resilience in the face of fear, gratitude for those who show up week after week to do the work of greeting strangers, or lifting their voices in song, or passing the baskets of nourishment along the rows, all while they feel that the world is unraveling at the seams. Grateful in sadness. I served as a hospital chaplain in Baltimore several years ago, and if you ever want an education in gratitude, go spend some time at a hospital. When one lives in such close proximity to sickness and death, I think that most people find practices of gratitude essential just for coping. Though working on the psychiatric unit was my most intense duty while I was there, I learned the most about gratitude from my stint with the folks in the elder care program. This was a day program where elders living in their own homes would be picked up in vans and brought to the hospital for group programs and breakfast and lunch and wraparound medical care. It basically provided the community and the fund and the medical support of a good nursing home, while allowing its members to stay in their own homes. When I began there, I think my second day, they told me that I would be responsible for leading a short worship service every morning that I was with them. "Excuse me?" I asked. I was a soft-spoken second-year seminarian at the time, and had only preached a handful of times, ever in my life, only a handful. The idea of leading worship multiple times a week for a multi-faith group of elders, most of whom struggled to even hear my voice, terrified me. But I racked my brain for worship topics that I thought would resonate with the evangelical Christians in the room and the members of the Nation of Islam in the room, with those who were cultural Jews in the room, with the atheists in the room. And what came to me over and over was the theme of gratitude. And so each morning I would arrive, a second-year seminarian, sweaty-palmed and heart beating fast, and I would pick up that beat-up old microphone that was at the front of the room, and after pressing the on button and then making sure I was holding the bottom properly so the batteries wouldn't fall out, because this wasn't a well-funded program, holding tight onto those batteries, I would ask the program participants what they were thankful for. And as they raised their hands, I would just walk around the room and hold the microphone out for each of them in turn. All kinds of gratitude were lifted up in that room. "I'm grateful for God," one would begin. "I'm grateful for my family," the next one would say. "I'm grateful for the bus driver who got me here this morning," another one would say. "I'm grateful for this program." They shared all kinds of gratitude, but the most common thing I heard said by them, the most common words spoken in that room were, "I'm grateful that I woke up this morning." Each time I invited them to share their gratitude, one after another of them would simply give thanks for waking up that day. Others around them would say, "Amen," and then they would ask for the microphone. And then they would say that they were grateful for waking up that morning. Every single day, so many of them said, "I'm just grateful for waking up this morning." Because what the elders in that program knew from watching their friends go one after another was that one day, all too soon, they would be the one who didn't wake up again. And that made each waking up so much more precious. Grateful in gladness, grateful in sadness. My friends, as you prepare for whatever Thanksgiving meal you might go to, or maybe just whatever shared meal you go to next, I invite you to remember that breaking bread with others is a revolutionary act, especially if it's with those who may not be like you, whether that's an uncle who is a diehard Trump supporter when maybe you were a Bernie fan, whether that's a person who asks for some help getting something to eat on the street, whether it's a person who offered that help when you asked, or even if it's just someone that you don't yet know. Breaking bread together turns them into us. Breaking bread together turns a stranger into a companion. Breaking bread together joins us in a revolution of loving across difference. As my colleague Galen Gingrich at All Souls in New York would say, because we are nurtured by the world around us, our first duty is to be grateful for the world around us. Because the world nurtures us, it is our job to be grateful. Grateful for the sun and the rain. Grateful for the bus driver that got us here. Grateful for each day. Amen. And may it be so.